From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent ABC News Washington Post poll has found that a whopping 75% of Americans and 85% of registered voters say they plan to vote in the 2020 presidential election. Past elections in the U.S. have struggled with turnout, in part because voters might feel apathetic, but also in large part because we make it difficult to vote. Unlike in many other democracies, American elections are held on weekdays rather than holidays. Strict voter ID laws have made it harder for elderly and rural voters, college age and brown and black voters to access the polls. Gerrymandered districts and the Electoral College dilute our votes. And yet the country has a rich history of fighting for the right to vote. That fight continues today in the face of myriad obstacles. And according to a new book, there is reason to feel heartened. Joshua A. Douglas is a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, focusing on the constitutional right to vote. He's a co-author of an election law casebook and co-editor of Election Law Stories. He joins me to discuss his new book called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you for having me.
So first, this idea that we live in a democracy, therefore everybody should have a say in how to run our government, is something that has had different interpretations over time. And many of us can probably point to the 1965 Voting Rights Act as that moment when, on paper at least, all Americans had finally their right to vote enshrined in law, right? But that was not the end of the story, right?
No, I mean, we've had this constant push and pull of voter restrictions along with voter expansions since our founding and continue to the present day. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was a great high moment in the struggle for the right to vote, but that's certainly not the end of the story.
What do we know about how people vote today? And that's a large part of your book is focused on that. What is it that drives a person who is eligible to vote to either register first and then actually vote or to not vote?
Well, I think, you know, the act of voting is one of civic duty and responsibility. It's also instilled in us, hopefully from early childhood, to be a part of this democracy. You know, our democracy is only strongest with the consent of the governed, and that should include everyone. And on the flip side, why a large segment of people don't vote, I think, comes from a handful of reasons. One is structural hurdles to the ballot box. We don't make it easy to vote in at least a lot of places. And then this sense of voter apathy that, you know, my vote won't matter, or why should I bother? The system is already, you know, rigged, whatever side you're on. And so I think the combination of that leads us to turnout rates of, you know, 60% in presidential elections. We had 50% turnout in the 2018 midterm, and that was a record and people were celebrating. And I thought, you know, why are we celebrating when half of the eligible electorate didn't show up? And I think it's a combination of those factors.
For those who don't have as many obstacles, that is, you know, who might have a job that makes it easy to vote, or that you already happen to have an ID in a state that that meets the requirements of that state, etc. You point out that voting is habit forming in your book. Explain that a little bit.
Yes, yeah, studies show that one of the biggest indicators of whether someone is going to vote if they voted previously. As you said, voting is habit forming. And also non-voting is a habit as well. And the political science studies show that if you miss the first election when you're an eligible voter, you're much less likely to become a habitual voter later in life. So one key is to capture people at the first possible time when they are eligible to vote, because if we instill in the importance of that civic responsibility at that moment, they're much more likely to become habitual voters. And I think strategies targeted towards that first election when someone is eligible can actually help us in the long term reach much higher turnout levels later on in life.
I imagine that it's very important for parents to take their kids with them to vote, to form that habit, to create a culture around voting so that when those kids are old enough to vote, that becomes something that they do.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my mom taking me to vote every election. It was in our elementary school gym. It was a very important part of the democratic experience that was instilled in me, and I try to instill in my children. But, you know, we can go beyond just parents bringing their kids to vote to engaging youngsters K through 12, as well as through adulthood, in better civics education. And, you know, I talk in the book about some schools that are doing innovative things about having students help at the polls. A lot of these things are ways that are already working in some places to instill the importance of democratic participation.
There are whole groups that are excluded from voting. I mean, assuming you're a citizen, obviously non-citizens are not allowed to vote. But we have the case in many states that felons, former felons, are not allowed to vote. And certainly those who are serving sentences aren't allowed to vote. And anybody under the age of 18 isn't allowed to vote. How could expanding voting rights to those excluded groups help? And are there efforts in those directions?
Yeah, so I do think we need to expand the electorate, and I spend some time talking about this. On the felon reenfranchisement front, there are movements in various states to ease the felon disenfranchisement laws in places where you wouldn't think it's likely to have success. Places like Kentucky, which has one of the worst, or if not the worst, felon disenfranchisement law in the country, in that it disenfranchises felons for life. And yet, thanks to the advocacy of an everyday American, a guy named West Powell, who I opened the book with, Kentucky was convinced to ease its felon disenfranchisement law just a little by passing a felony expungement bill. We can talk about another place like Florida, a big battleground in elections, and the state's voters just passed a state constitutional amendment to remove its lifetime ban on felon voting rights, which will reenfranchise about 1.4 million Americans. And then when we speak about the voting age in youngsters, there are actually a handful of places in the country that allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in local elections. It started in Tacoma Park, Maryland in 2013, the first place to do it. It expanded to other places like Hyattsville, Maryland, then hopped across the country. Berkeley, California, enfranchised 16 and 17-year-olds for school board elections. And I actually just saw that the Los Angeles School Board has authorized a feasibility study about lowering the voting age to 16 and 17 for school board elections there. So this is a movement that is gaining steam, at least at the local or school board level.
So kids, teenagers, 16 through 18, if they do have the right to vote and actually start voting at that age, are also, because of what we talked about earlier, more likely to keep voting once they form the habit of doing so, which of course will increase our voter rolls, which is really critical if we want a healthy democracy.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, 16 is actually a much better age to start the habit of voting, at least for local elections, for the simple reason that we know where most of them are, right? They're in high school, so we can more easily have them register. We can more easily instill civics education, meaningful civics education, about the importance of participating in our government. You know, 18 is kind of a strange age to start the voting habit if we think about most people are going out, you know, leaving home, they're entering the workforce or going off to school, they're moving away, and they must jump through the hoops of both registering and then requesting an absentee ballot in most places. And so if we lower the voting age to 16 for local elections and couple that with meaningful civics education, as you say, we can create this whole new generation of engaged voters. And it's happening locality by locality thanks to this hard work of these really amazing everyday Americans.
Now, there's an interesting aspect to the U.S. voting system, which maybe we don't question very much, but maybe we should, which is that one has to first register to vote in order to vote. And most states have a registration deadline weeks or months before election day. But that is essentially just another artificial hurdle to voting, isn't it? And what are some ways in which that registration aspect is something that voting rights activists are taking on and winning on?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, voter registration deadlines are really a relic of an anti-immigrant sentiment after World War I, where states were looking for ways to essentially make it harder for certain constituencies to vote. And a recent study showed that the states with the longest registration deadlines, that is the deadline before Election Day by when you have to be registered, have the lowest turnout rates in the country. States with reforms like automatic voter registration and same-day registration have the highest turnout. And of course, this makes sense. As you note, registration is a hurdle that people have to jump over just to be able to exercise the most fundamental right in our democracy. Now, you asked about success stories. Automatic voter registration is a clear one. This started in Oregon just a few years ago, thanks to the advocacy of a guy named Steve Trout, the elections director there, who basically thought, you know, why are we making people opt in? We have the information that we need about them through the DMV database. Can't the DMV database and the voter registration database essentially talk to each other? And this allows the voter rolls actually to be updated dynamically. So it also cleans up the voter rolls. And this then spread to other places like West Virginia and Georgia and a handful of other states on both the so-called left and the so-called right politically, because it makes a lot of sense. It makes it easier to register. It cleans up the voter rolls. It's cheaper. It's really one of those win-win stories that helps to improve our democracy.
And what do taco trucks have to do with voter registration? I'm quoting the title of chapter 3 of your book, Vote for Us.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite chapter titles, and one of my favorite pictures in the book is of a taco truck in Houston, where this group called Mi Familia Vota, a Latino organization that is tied to Latino outreach, went to Latino-heavily areas in Houston and went to the taco trucks there and brought them voter registration forms. And the people there loved it. These were areas where campaigns and candidates hardly ever go. Elected officials don't usually affirmatively reach out to these areas. And yet, just by the simple means of bringing voter registration forms to these taco trucks, more Latinos registered to vote. In fact, on the voter registration deadline, the director of Mi Familia Vota, a guy named Carlos Duarte, was receiving phone calls from the taco trucks asking for more forms because so many people had requested them to register. And turnout in these areas went up after this happened. So these things really work.
Now, of course, if White House advisor Stephen Miller were to hear what you just said, he would advise President Donald Trump that these are, quote unquote, illegals voting in our elections and they should be purged and, they're committing voter fraud. I mean, there's so many virulently racist attacks on the right to vote that, unfortunately, the GOP in particular very specifically has been casting in trying to whittle away our right to vote. Not only has Trump, of course, President Donald Trump jumped on this bandwagon to help explain why he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes in 2016, but also we have longtime Secretary of State in Kansas, Chris Kobach, who's made it his life's mission to make it harder for Black and brown people to vote. These are some of our modern day hurdles to voting, right?
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate. It's harmful for democracy. And my answer to those kinds of allegations is show me the evidence, right? Just because taco trucks were popular places to receive voter registration forms does not mean that these were people who were not allowed to vote, that they were non-citizens, that this led to voter fraud. You know, every time you hear these stories about massive voter fraud, they get embellished sometimes in the media. And then when you dive down, you see they weren't actually anything there at all. This just happened recently in Texas, where there was allegations of massive non-citizen voting in Texas. And then somewhat quietly, the Texas election officials walked back their statements when it turned out that they didn't have any evidence at all. So President Trump, Mr. Miller, if you want to keep peddling those allegations, I ask you, show me the evidence.
Then on to actually voting. Say one does pass the hurdle of registering to vote. Even the act of voting can be really difficult for people who might work far from where they live, for people who face long lines at the polls. There are people who every election complain that their voting center has been moved yet again, or they have the wrong address, etc. Or when they showed up, their registration wasn't on file and they had to cast a provisional ballot. Why is the actual act of voting, once one is in the right demographic, has actually passed the hurdle of registration, why is it so difficult?
Well, because many places are still living in a time period from decades ago, where we have this notion that we have to vote at our home-based precinct, close to home. And we have this ritual that we have to wait in line and, you know, see the poll workers check in with them and go to the machine that's outdated. You know, but the good news is that there are some places who have gone past that with two particular reforms that work really well. One's known as vote centers. So instead of having to go to your home-based precinct, the place closest to your house, you can go to any vote center in the county. And they're all connected electronically so that once you check in one place, you can't check in anywhere else. And the ballot that's printed is the ballot for your home address. But imagine the convenience factor of being able to vote anywhere in the county, no matter if you're closer to work, you're out doing errands, you're closer to school or whatever. And this was started largely by a guy named Scott Doyle in Larimer County, Colorado, a Republican engineer who joined the county clerk's office late in his career. And he was frustrated when he heard about voters who showed up at the end of election day to the wrong precinct and then were turned away and ultimately didn't have the opportunity to vote. And he said, there's got to be a better way. And he said, you know, why can't voting be like food shopping? I can go to my supermarket no matter where I am and find basically the same thing. Can't voting be the same way? They implemented that in Larimer County, Colorado. It started to spread to lots of other places because the voters love it. It's actually in the long run cheaper. And so this helps to improve turnout. And now it's in a handful of places. I just saw that Houston is going to be adopting vote centers. I believe Kansas, I think the governor, the new governor has authorized its counties to use vote centers. And then the other form is universal vote by mail, which I know California is moving towards, where every voter is automatically mailed a ballot, whether they request one or not, a couple weeks before election day. So you can fill it out, research the issues, research the candidates from your home, and then drop it off with a secure drop box or put it in the mail. These really improve turnout. In fact, the states with the highest turnout also have universal vote by mail systems.
One of the very important aspects of accessibility to voting, which you write about in your book, is a demographic we haven't yet discussed, which is disabled Americans. And I feel like this is really important for us to talk about, because for every hurdle there is to vote, including registering, showing up at the polls, there can be very serious challenges for disabled voters. What are some of the challenges that disabled voters face, and how are activists working to erase those challenges to make it easier for this particular community?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because often it's a community that is overlooked, and yet turnout among disabled voters is lower than non-disabled voters. And this is one reason I devoted an entire chapter to this topic. You have hurdles like, you know, the typical things of accessibility to the polling place, but I think also more concerning, or maybe just as concerning, but not talked about as much, are inaccessible voting machines or a polling place that has one machine that's dedicated for disabled voters that often the poll workers don't know how to use. I have a former law student who's blind who told me about how he waited 45 minutes to vote because the poll workers at his polling station were trying to figure out how to turn on the one machine that was accessible for him. They had to call the county clerk's office. Not only did he have to wait the 45 minutes, but everyone in line behind him had to wait as well. But there's actually a better way, or at least innovative solutions for this. One is done by a group of researchers at the University of Florida, led by Dr. Juan Gilbert, a machine that he calls Prime 3, and where it's been implemented, they call it All for One. And it's a voting machine that anyone can use, whether you're disabled or fully abled, whether you're blind, deaf, mobility impaired, no disabilities at all. It's the same machine, and it's got attachments for the various different possibilities. And this really reduces the stigma of having a disability, because you're treated like everyone else. You know, I talked to two blind voters in New Hampshire that helped to have the all-for-one machine implemented in a couple counties there for their elections. Machines are actually relatively cheap compared to other voting machines. And they said it really helped the accessibility issues, and it made them feel like they didn't have as much of a stigma. Now, of course, we also need to talk when we think about these kinds of machines about having a paper trail and the verifiability, and those are all things that the researchers are considering. But to me, voter access is really the key to make it easier for everyone to vote.
And then there are things like the ways in which voters can inform themselves in a proper way to actually vote. We live in an era where there seems to be so much polarization of views, and so much of our information is diluted with propaganda. And that's really no other word for it than propaganda. If we look at the health of the 2016 election, you know, voters just spent millions of dollars, taxpayers just spent millions of dollars on a 2-year-long investigation about how our election was so deeply problematic in 2016. Notwithstanding the efforts by countries like Russia to influence us, we also have just tremendous amount of lies, propaganda, that are even part of people's and candidates' campaigning that are seeking to sway voters. I mean, that I suppose should emphasize to us voters just how important our vote is. There are so many efforts to try to sway us. But what about these other challenges that don't involve the mechanics and the logistics of voting?
Yeah, and I'm glad you used the word lies, because, you know, when the president tweets that 3 million illegal immigrants voted in our elections, that's just a blatant lie. I think there is a solution, though, and the solution is to trust local journalism. Mm-hmm. Local journalists are on the ground in communities really working on ensuring the government is transparent and informing the electorate, and yet we don't support, as a society, local journalism like we should, with our wallets, with our eyeballs on their websites, and with our trust. You know, I have the fortune of speaking to a lot of local journalists who want to talk about election law and voting rights issues, and they're not biased. They're just trying to inform the public the best they can. You know, we know of a couple of national TV stations or TV news programs that have a particular skew, right? But they don't shy away from that. But the local journalists on the ground, they're fighting for resources, there's fewer and fewer of those resources available. I think we can root out, you know, so-called fake news and this propaganda by really reinvesting in local newspapers, local journalism, because they're really the truth seekers and the truth finders in our democracy.
I understand that you're going to be coming to Los Angeles, where our program is based, on Thursday, June 20th at the Last Bookstore in downtown LA. Tickets do need to be purchased by June 6th. And we will link to your website, joshuaadouglas.com, where people can get access to that information if they click on Book Tour. Again, that website is joshuaadouglas.com. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sally. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Joshua A. Douglas, professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, focusing on the constitutional right to vote. And we've been discussing his latest book. It's called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.